And before we start, let me just tell you a little bit what we're going to be doing. I'm going to insert something that's not on the notes, number 8, just a little, and if you want to take notes on your back, I should have, but I decided to include briefly, probably 5 minutes worth of material on the issue of women, increased interest in women doing things in the church, a little bit about the missionary vision, and then a little wrap up on Native American missions using the Cherokees as an example, and talk about the kind of the tragedy, if you will, of the Cherokees and the removal and the issues connected with that. And then we're going to spend some time on two related but actually quite distinct in their own ways issues. And that's the issue of the religious outsiders to the evangelical mainstream. And in that we will look at churches that are traditionally orthodox in the small O Christian churches, but didn't fit the evangelical category. That would be the revivalistic evangelical category is probably the better way to put it. That will include strong confessional Reformed and Lutherans. It will include Roman Catholics and some of the Episcopalians briefly. We'll talk about them. We're also going to spend some time on the Roman Catholic Church because this is the time period, same period which is the evangelical heyday in America, is the time when Roman Catholics begin their rise. Till about the time of the Civil War, they are the largest single denomination in America. Now, when you add all the Protestants up, of course, they are still very much a minority. But by the time of the Civil War, they are the single most, the largest religious body in America. They go from being a tiny handful at the American Revolution to being the largest by the Civil War in those 80 years, which is also very interesting. But we're also going to look at these groups and talk about how they bounce off, if you want to use a big category term, from the evangelical mainstream, either as the foil for the evangelical mainstream. The Catholic menace was huge in the minds of evangelical leaders. They were sure the United States was about ready to be totally overtaken by Rome. The second thing would be sometimes these groups actually borrowed things from the evangelical mainstream. You'll be surprised to learn about Catholic revivalism, which there was. The other thing is several of the very unusual groups, the groups that we would tend to call cults, we need to see how they developed out of the evangelical mainstream in several ways. One way is in reaction to them, but also borrowing ideas from the evangelical mainstream. And we will talk a little bit about the African American church, which starts to come into its own during this time too. Now that's certainly theologically part of the evangelical mainstream, but sociologically it is not. So let's pray, and then we will briefly talk about these first few things and then get into the meat of what we're looking at tonight. Gracious Lord, we thank you for the opportunity to learn tonight. We pray that as we study these varied groups, that we would be able to assess your work in the past, think through our own ways in which we involve ourselves in the work of your kingdom, and ask for your gracious blessing on our time tonight. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, before we actually get to the even outsiders, we would talk briefly about a couple of other quick issues. Women. Women always made up the largest majority of members of churches from the colonial days on. But the earliest colonial day churches, with the exception of the Quakers, women were very restricted. Women speaking in church, that's how, remember, we talked about Anne Hutchinson and how she got herself in such big trouble when she was leading her Bible study and on Pastor Cotton's sermons and was challenging some of the ministers in town and how scandalous it was in colonial period that it was a woman that was doing this. Yet we will discover during this period between 1800 and 1850, this period we're working with here, women began to take a far more active role in the life of the church. It's no accident that we find in this period, the first woman ordained to a pulpit ministry. Now, it was in a very liberal branch of the Congregationalists, a woman named Antoinette Brown, who later joined the Unitarians, which kind of shows her theological proclivities very, very clearly. But there had earlier been women revivalists. The Free Will Baptists had a woman named Nancy Towle, who had preached regularly up and down the East Coast. And although she was not ordained, she actually once spoke before Congress, which is surprising to hear that a Free Will Baptist woman evangelist had spoken before Congress. But what really was the outlet for women during this time were all of these multitude, as we've talked about, of the societies. The Society for the Reformation of Morals, the Temperance Society, the Anti-Slavery Society, the Bible and Tract Society, the Missionary Society. Because oftentimes women made overwhelmingly the largest membership in these societies. They were oftentimes given leadership roles in these societies, and women found an outlet. As I said, the Temperance, many of you heard of the WCTU, Frances Willard. That comes a little later. She was a Methodist, product of the revival movement. That movement is post-Civil War, but she typifies the growth of this. Abolition of Slavery, the Grinke Sisters, Educational Opportunities for Women, Catherine Beecher, Better treatment of the Mentally Ill, a woman named Dorothy Dix. All of these flowed out of the revival movement. And the earliest women's rights movement comes out of this as well. Many of you have probably heard about the famous Seneca Fall convention, in which the key leaders, Lucretia Mott and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, developed what they call that phase one of feminism. It was held in the Wesleyan Methodist Church, an evangelical Methodist church in Seneca Falls, New York. So modern-day feminism has really forgotten all of that, but that's where its earliest roots were evangelical Methodists. Some groups, women became leaders. We aren't going to talk much about the Shakers. They would be a good example of one of these unusual groups. But the leader of the Shakers was a woman named Ann Lee, who claimed that she was the second coming of Christ. She advocated celibacy, frugality, communalism, millennialism, pacifism, vegetarianism, spiritualism, and making lots of furniture. And they did it. Now, as you will quickly discover, you don't grow if you advocate celibacy unless you have lots of converts. And in the early days when they had lots of converts, they grew. But the last I heard, about 20 years ago, there were two really old women in Kentucky who were left of the Shakers. I don't think they're alive still, but I have not checked out on that. But that's what it got down to two, pushing 90-year-old women in Kentucky a few years ago. So the movement has died, other than in the furniture and other sorts of things like that. But we will find that there are other movements that will develop female leadership. Seventh-day Adventists, Christian Science. And this new impetus toward women's involvement will be for both good and, in the case of some of these cults, ill, because they will come up with some very bizarre things sometimes. Missions we've talked about briefly. Well, before we get to our outsiders, missions picked up during this time. We have the famous Haystack Missionary Prayer Meeting, the founding of the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions in 1810. Andover Seminary was founded very heavily as an Orthodox alternative to Harvard, which had become Unitarian, and it was heavily mission-oriented. And there were lots of missionaries that began to be sent out. The most famous, of course, was Adoniram Judson, who started out as a Congregationalist, and on the boat he and his wife decided they were really Baptists, and which caused a small amount of consternation to the American Board of Commissioners of Foreign Missions. The Congregationalists sent them out, because then what did they do? The people they sent out had changed their theology, but they ended up forming in Burma a very strong Baptist missionary movement, and they're still descendants of those converts in Burma today. There was continuation of outreach to Native Americans, and the most tragic example, and I just wanted to leave you with this before we get to the outsiders, is the Cherokees. Because the Cherokees had sided with the British during the American Revolution, and the U.S. government exacted retribution against them for that. And they signed a peace treaty, which gave them a very limited place in North Georgia and in western North Carolina, in in the Appalachian Mountains, the Smoky Mountains were there. If you ever vacationed in the Smoky Mountains, that was Cherokee territory. And what it had, though, was an interesting effect of stimulating a cultural revival, if you will, about them, among them. And they built roads, they organized politically, developed their own language, and various Christian missionaries had a great deal of success among them. First, Moravians and Presbyterians, Congregationalists and Baptists all had serious, effective missions among them. Gradually, in spite of opposition of some who stressed the native religions, some version of Protestant faith basically captured most of the, at least nominally, most of the Cherokees. There were Cherokee churches all over the place in that area of North Georgia and the Smoky Mountains. Key leader was a man named Elias Boudinot, who had studied at a local Native academy and then went to Andover Seminary, where he was trained. It wasn't just a local revival preacher who was converted yesterday and today will make you a preacher. He was seminary trained and a very competent seminary trained pastor. Yet gold was discovered in North Georgia. And unfortunately, white settlers decided they had to have that land. And the Cherokees were pushed out. Boudinot and others, and a significant number of other white missionaries, went to the government and said, "We have a treaty that says this land is ours. These people are, quote, civilized tribes." And that's what they were called. They were part of the so-called civilized. They are Christians. And they have a relatively high degree of serious Christianity, not just like what the Jesuits had up in Canada, where it was a most thin veneer of Christianity you could have had. These were serious Christians. And if you know the story with the Trail of Tears, even the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the Cherokees, and Andrew Jackson supposedly said, "Well, John Marshall has made his ruling, let him try to enforce it now." Out with the Cherokees. And they marched them all the way out to Oklahoma. Thousands died on the Trail of Tears, and in spite of mission executives, Supreme Court justices, everybody trying to block it, Andrew Jackson had his way, and they moved him out to Oklahoma. So this is one of the sad tales in the history of Indian, Native American, Indian, white Americans' relationship. And basically, it destroyed the whole tribal structure of the Cherokee tribe, but a significant number of them, of course, kept their Christian faith, and they just basically moved it to Oklahoma. But it's a sad story. Well, now we're going to get to the main topic of tonight, the outsiders, alternative communities. First, we'll just give a little overview, and we'll talk about one of the more interesting ones, just to kind of as a teaser to get into this. Utopian communities, and there would be those. What's a utopian community? That's a community that decides they can build heaven on earth. And there were lots of them. There were lots of utopian communities. Some were secular. Some were the one Walden Farm by Walden Pond, which was a bunch of intellectual, kind of fruitcakey sort of New Englanders who went out there, and it kind of fell apart. But the most interesting one to me is the Oneida community. John Humphrey Noyes was the follower, N-O-Y-E-S. You see his dates, how he's right smack in the middle of this period. He had gone to Yale and Andover Seminary. You can't get a more pristine, during this period, theological training, right in the heart of evangelical congregationalism in New England. But this is showing you how a group like the Oneida community flows out of evangelicalism and takes its interesting twist. He had adopted perfectionistic ideas. Remember, we had seen those before in their own way in Methodism and in Finney. The idea that you could be perfected by an act of faith, you could be perfected. Well, he took this and really ran with it. So what did he start saying? He said that believers in his movement were all sinlessly perfect, that Christ had indeed returned to earth in 1839, that a form of communitarian socialist living was the way for perfected Christians to bring the kingdom of God to earth. He organized a group of what he called Bible communists. This was before the Communist Manifesto was ever even written, but he organized a group of Bible communists in 1840 in Vermont, which took an interesting turn in 1846 when he started advocating plural marriages. Now you may say, oh, I thought the Mormons invented it. Well, this is not Mormon-style plural marriage where, like Brigham Young, you can have 18 wives or how many of them. I've forgotten how many he actually had. This is where everybody is married to everybody else. And nobody could possess, that was the word that was used, anybody else. And you can imagine how this shocked people in traditional New England. Just like it would actually still shock most Americans today, even pagan Americans, the idea that we all live together in a commune and everyone is married to everybody else. That's what they called it. Everyone is plurally married to everybody else. Now, they had all kinds of strict rules of how this could operate, and you had to follow the protocol, and it wasn't just like, you know, free love, if you will. It was clear protocol how you did this, but it was part of the extension of his perfectionism. We're perfected now. We're like the angels in heaven, and so we are married, everyone to each other. Nobody has nobody can possess another woman or another man, so we're all married to each other. Well, it eventually fizzled because this was the scandalous position that caused all sorts of people to eventually, get shocked at the movement. But interestingly enough, the movement moved to Oneida, New York in 1851, where 200 members farmed and started making silverware. And if any of you are familiar with the Oneida Silverware Company, that is where it got its start, because once they gave up the communal living, the plural marriages, and all the other interesting things connected with the Oneida Society, they still decided there was money to be made in making silverware. So they did. Noyes himself had to flee to Canada to avoid prosecution, and in 1881, once everything was dismissed from the religious movement, they formed a joint stock company. And they had all given up on the religion long before that, but they formed a joint stock company, everyone who had been a member of the Oneida Society. Now, there were other groups like the Harmony Society, led by George Rapp, the Ephrata Commune, which had a communal society, and then one that's a little closer to home. Just drive down Interstate 80, about 30 miles west of Iowa City, you will hear about a place called the Amana Society. This movement came into the U.S. during this period as well. The Amana colonies were a communal living group. If you've been out there and ever seen the little videos that they have in the historical center, they'll talk about communal living. It emphasized direct inspiration, communal living, and pacifism. If you took the communal living, the direct inspiration, and the pacifism out of the Amana societies, what you have is basically a pietistic version of traditional Lutheranism. When you add on communal living, pacifism, and direct inspiration, you have a very different kind of a group. And they got themselves in trouble in Germany. And they had formed, actually, over 100 years before this, in 1714. They came to upstate New York in 1842. And just before the Civil War, they moved out here to Iowa. In 1932, it actually became a joint stock company. And that's what it is today. They own thousands of acres of land right along the Iowa River there. And if you are a member of the original, a descendant of the member of the original Amana colonies, you have stock in this. And if you're a farmer, you can have options on maybe farming 1,200 acres this year. But it's still all owned by the Amana Society, and you just have your joint stock gives you the privilege of farming that land. And that's what they did with it. And there's still an Amana church out there. I think it very much has toned down the direct inspiration, and it's just kind of a mildly Lutheran-flavored church now of some sort. I knew someone who had grown up into that, and that's the way he described it to me one time. But they still read the testimonies of the inspired prophets in their worship services. So that's still a holdover from the time of direct inspiration. Now, these are, with the exception of the Oneida community, a few more of the more interesting ones, but most of these are the ones that fizzled. We're going to talk about later tonight on two that in their own way continued and show how. Now, can you see, by the way, how some of these kind of came out, several of the broader evangelical movement? Before we do that, we want to talk briefly about some outsiders that are orthodox in their basic theology, don't have, at least in their basic doctrine of God, basic doctrine of the Trinity, basic doctrine of Christ. We need to talk, first of all, about the African American, the black churches. And this is an interesting way to describe them, because you might say, well, why are they outsiders? Well, their doctrine places them as insiders, but the sociology places them as cultural outsiders. In other words, doctrinally, you could find very little difference between a black Methodist, black Baptist, or a black Presbyterian. Those are the three groups. Baptists were the largest, Methodists a strong second, and Presbyterians way far behind, but there still were some black Presbyterian, Cumberlands especially, black Cumberland Presbyterians. Other groups just fizzled until we get to the rise in about 1900 of Pentecostalism, and then black Pentecostalism will take off like crazy. But in this period, we have Baptist, Methodist, and trailing far behind some version of Presbyterianism. But the majority of black African Americans in the United States became, during this period, some sort of at least nominal Protestants. Their numbers were growing. And much of the impetus for the conversion of slaves did not come, as we've seen, from the slave owners themselves, but most of it came from within the black community. And it led to the formation of black churches that sometimes were actually illegal during this period, because the owners wanted them to attend church with them and sit in a separate spot, let's say in the balcony or in the back, and it did not like the idea that there would be separate churches. But what would oftentimes, from the history, the oral histories, and most of these are oral histories that we have, they would hold separate meetings, often in secret. Sometimes they would hold them on a Sunday afternoon, because you have to remember, this is still the period when there's strong Sabbatarianism in the United States. And most slave owners, if they were members of any evangelical church, would have not worked on Sunday. They would have given their slaves the day off. And that meant that they could go out into the woods a lot of times and hold separate services on Sunday afternoon. And they developed their own style. There were separate African-American churches. Most important one was the African-American Episcopal Church, which was founded among free blacks in the North by a man named Richard Allen in Philadelphia in 1814. We have that up there. He was converted while still a slave on a Delaware plantation. And the reason he found this denomination was because white trustees tried to force them out of worshiping in white churches in Philadelphia. The Methodists prevented them from holding their own property, so they decided to form their own denomination. He became its first bishop, and also the leader of the National Negro Convention, which was the first black political organization among free blacks in the United States. He argued that the Methodist message, as he called it, was the best message for African Americans to have. That was his argument. There were other black churches that followed. There was a black Episcopal church that was very small. There were smaller black Methodist organizations. There were a whole bunch of black independent, mostly black Baptist churches. After the Civil War, the African American black Baptist churches would organize. We'll have to pick up some of that when we get out of this period until after the Civil War. But this period is our period when we're starting to see not just converted African Americans who sit in the back and the balcony in white churches, but actual organization of African American churches. Now, interestingly enough, some of them, the preachers, had very minimal education. And their knowledge of the Bible was mostly memorized. They had listened to the Bible enough that they had memorized it. Sometimes they were illiterate, but they preached the gospel. Sometimes it would get interestingly mixed up with certain practices that had come from Africa. There are certain things that historians of African American religion have traced to African folk traditions that got carried over in some of these black churches. It's not so much those things affected the theology, they didn't. But they affected the practice sometimes of the way African Americans worshiped, because they would take things that had been common cultural practices in Africa and were carried over by African Americans, and they would be incorporated into their church. Now, white people were oftentimes rather nervous about this because they were always afraid that this could be fomenting of slave revolts. And there was a black slave, a couple of them, Nat Turner in 1831, and a man named Denmark Vesey in 1822, who in the name of Christianity led slave revolts. Nat Turner's in particular was pretty bloody. And there were several white masters, cruel white masters, who were killed. And this put a kind of a damper for a few years on these separate black churches. But we have the start of African-American organized Christianity during this period. But now we need to turn to the Roman Catholics. This is the period in which Roman Catholics come into the United States in large numbers and begin to have an impact on American Catholic life and American life in general. 1789, first bishop appointed, 35,000 Roman Catholics in America, mostly in Maryland. There were 30 priests. Now, the numbers are a little hard to always nail down for Catholics. And Catholic historians will tell you that, but this is a number I've seen, 300,000 by 1830. You can do the math and see we have considerable growth during this period. Now, the problem with Catholic statistics are this. Sometimes the Roman Catholics themselves, when they put their statistics down, counted everybody who had been baptized and was nominally Catholic back in Ireland or Germany or France or wherever they happened to, French Canada, wherever they happened to come from. And if you know anything about traditional Roman Catholicism, you know there's always it takes on a folk religion practice in a lot of those countries. It's got a parish system where everybody in the parish is Roman Catholic. That means everybody, unless you are the village atheist and refuse to have your kids baptized. Everybody is Catholic. So sometimes they would then count every Irishman that came over, unless he was a Northern Irish Presbyterian, he was a Catholic. Every German from Bavaria that came over, unless he was one of the minority Lutherans in Bavaria, was a Catholic. Well, we know that a significant number of them were as nominal as can be, just like there were nominal Protestants, lots of them. Well, there were lots of nominal Roman Catholics. But we do know that within 30 years, by 1860, on the eve of the Civil War, if we follow some reasonable estimate of the number, we have 3 million. That's a huge number. Now, we did add a few. And that, by the way, is a 10 times growth in comparison to a 2.5 times growth of the American population. Think about that. The numbers of at least nominal Roman Catholics grew 10 times. The population grew 2.5 times. That gives you some idea of this huge shift of Roman Catholic presence in the United States. Now, 440,000 were added in the Louisiana Purchase, mostly descendants of French and Spanish, mostly French. New Orleans, the Cajuns, St. Louis, little scattered French outposts. But the biggest bulk during this period were German and Irish immigrants. And this would, sorry to get this in, this ended up being smaller. Hopefully you can all still read that up there. In the 1840s, 800,000 Irish came. Now, the earliest leaders, and in 900,000 came in the 1850s, 400,000 Germans came, 1 million in the 1850s, and many Germans were Roman Catholics. The earliest leaders of the Catholics in the United States were descendants of colonial English Catholics, like John Carroll of Maryland, and he was a son of wealthy merchants from the Carroll family, which is that Roman Catholic family in Maryland. He was French educated by Jesuits. He wrote a book defending the patriotism of Roman Catholics during the Revolutionary War. He was made the first bishop and later Archbishop of Baltimore. Many of the early other bishops came from similar background, English Catholic background. What you will discover is that there's this shift in the leadership in the Roman Catholic Church. Earliest were English. Then there would be still mostly English bishops, but a few French, but especially lots of French priests. That's because Carroll had been educated in France. And the French Revolution took place during this time. And there were thousands, actually, hundreds if not thousands of French priests who were persona non grata in France because of the French Revolution. They were guillotining them and chasing them out under the radical secularism of the French Revolution. Since Carroll had studied in France under Jesuits, he recruited these priests because there was a huge shortage of priests to staff schools and churches. He founded Georgetown College, which is now Georgetown University, a premier Roman Catholic college. He set in motion the Provisional Council, which met after his death to develop some ways the Roman Catholic Church would adapt to the American culture. But what we will see is that those first few generations were French in leadership, but the earliest immigrants were mostly Irish and German. After it was the Irish that first got restless under this. Like, why in the world we've got all these Frenchmen running our church? And very quickly, because the Irish were English-speaking, they moved into the priesthood. And if you know anything about Catholic history since then, just look at the names of most Catholic bishops in the United States. All the O'Connors and O'Malleys and O-whatevers. And the Irish still have a lock on the largest numbers of Catholic leadership in the United States. Even when in the late 19th century, the Italians and the Poles and others would come in. Now, there's great stories later on when the Italians came in and had their own set of saints that were special saints that the popes kind of winked at and said, ah, you Sicilians, you can have those. And Irish bishops would look up in their book of official saints' days and discover they weren't real saints' days with that name and try to tell the Italians they couldn't have it. And the Italians would get really mad and say, yes, we can. And they'd say, well, who told you? Well, the Pope told us we could have those special saints. Well, there's no saint in the book with that name. You want to believe it? There is. Yes, there is. You know, and so there were all these interesting squabbles between ethnic groups and the hierarchy. But the other factor that they faced was the fact that there had been this shortage of priests for all these years, and Catholic parishes oftentimes ran themselves, the laymen ran them, and all of a sudden, when you have a priest and a bishop coming in and telling you what to do, it's the same problem that the Episcopal Church had to impose a hierarchy on the church. A lot of the Catholics were restless about this, these Catholic parishes. Well, we've been running our things quite well without you. We need a priest to come along and give us Mass once in a while, but don't tell us what to do. And so they had tensions over what they call lay trustees. Bishops claiming the exclusive rights to appoint priests, and local parishes saying, wait a minute, you know, we would like some say in all of this. This is America, after all. What do our Presbyterian and Baptist friends do? They get to elect, you know, who their pastor is. How come we got to go back to this old way of doing things? And when these bishops would try to tell them, well, this is what Catholics do. It's an Episcopal system. The priest is appointed by the bishop. Well, why? You know, and there were tensions, lots of tensions on this. But the biggest problem that they had was for the Catholics, was Protestant opposition. Protestant opposition during this period was absolutely huge. Now, today for us, we oftentimes will look upon Roman Catholics and we will say, well, you know, I know, especially on October 31st, Reformation Day, we will say, yes, we know we have our differences. And on the doctrine of salvation, what we believe is a huge difference. But we share a doctrine of the Trinity. We share Christology with them. We share a number of key doctrines with them, a Bible, mostly common. They have the apocryphal books, but most of the Bible is common. All sorts of things we can say. And we also are co-belligerents with them sometimes in some political and cultural issues. But you have to understand, during this period, 1820s to the 1860s, Protestants as a whole looked with great fear. They had this tradition, this Puritan-based tradition, this remembering the Spanish Inquisition, remembering the Spanish Armada tradition of don't trust the papists, don't trust the Romanists. And there were Lyman Beecher, for example, one of the great Presbyterian later congregations, later Presbyterian ministers, founder of Lane Seminary, wrote a famous book called The Plea for the West. And about a third of that book was full of the Catholic menace. Those people are coming, and that's the kind of language he said. They're going to take over the West. If we don't get missionaries out here right away, they're going to swarm us. They're going to overtake us. Now, this had interesting ramifications. Some of the ramifications were that there were huge squabbles. And in the 1840s, we may not realize this, but in the city of Philadelphia, there were 3 days of Protestant-Catholic rioting that shut the city down, and they had to bring the military out to squelch it. The police were not able to handle it. Bishop Hughes in New York, when he heard about this, because the idea behind it, they were going to burn down the churches. Literally, Protestant mobs were going to burn down the Catholic churches. Bishop Hughes hired armed Catholic guards, loyal Catholic guards, and he could put guns in their hands because he said the police aren't going to do anything. Look what they did in Philadelphia. The soldiers couldn't even do it. So he stationed armed guards with rifles around the church, and the mobs didn't attack his churches. That gives you some idea. They burned down a famous Ursuline convent in Boston. All sorts of issues. Now, this is obviously interconnected with immigration. It's connected with the fact that Irish laborers worked for cheap. That was a big factor. But there were also a whole series of scandalous kind of books. The most famous one was written by a woman called herself Maria Monk. And she told lurid stories of how underneath convents there were dungeons where they hid the bodies of the children born to nuns illegitimately, and so they killed them all and put them on those graves underneath the convents. A whole series of these books. That book was reprinted in the 1950s. So it gives you an idea that it went through several printings in the 19th century. So this is not just a little flash in the pan. This was major stuff. And there were still Roman Catholics who for years had to deny that there were these secret burial grounds, you know, and the way it went, well, why did they wear those big habits? Well, I guess that they're hiding, they're pregnant underneath them, and all kinds of stuff like this. This was a regular thing that was tossed out there. So the tensions between Protestants and Catholics were high during this period. It got into squabbles over, and this is how I'm showing you how the Catholic issue gets interconnected with the evangelical mainstream. For example, Bishop Hughes petitioned the New York City School Board for money for the Roman Catholic schools because he said they couldn't go to the Protestant schools because they read the Protestant Bible there. This is during the great period when they still read the Bible every day in school. But the problem that it came down to is, which Bible do you read, the King James or the Douay? And the Catholics said, we're not going to that school because they read the wrong Bible. They read the Protestant Bible there. So one of the key reasons for parish schools in the United States is because Catholics said they read the wrong Bible. That's the truth. One of the key reasons for parish schools, Catholic schools, is because Protestants read the wrong Bible. And Bishop Hughes tried to get money to set up his schools. He says it's only fair. This issue of aid for private education goes way back to the 1840s. They turned him down flat. They basically said, if you don't come to our non-sectarian. And the Catholics complained, they're not non-sectarian, they're just interdenominational Protestant schools. They read the King James Bible every day. What do you mean they're non-sectarian? Big debate. Still not solved today. It gets even more interesting when you find out about how this affected the political realm. There were a number of secret societies formed that were very clearly anti-Roman Catholic. The most interesting one was the Order of the Star-Spangled Banner. The Order of the Star-Spangled Banner, to be a member of the Order of the Star-Spangled Banner, you had to prove, number one, that you had like three or four generations, you've been here in the United States, and you had no Catholics in your background. And you had to prove, and it was, it had secret handshakes and secret oaths, just like a Masonic lodge or something like that. And as one historian said, and a lot of other mumbo jumbo. That's what one historian said in the Order of the Star-Spangled Banner. But it put itself into politics because there was a party called the American Republican Party. This predates the what we have as the Republican Party today. It was called the American Republican Party. At one time, it elected 75 members into Congress. And to be a candidate in the American Republican Party, you also had to belong to the Order of the Star-Spangled Banner. Now, they didn't tell you that up front. But in reality, you wouldn't get the nomination in the American Republican Party unless you were also a member of the Order of the Star-Spangled Banner. 75 members to the House of Representatives in the 1854 election, and they completely dominated the Massachusetts state legislature. Now, can you imagine, we talk about nativism today, having 75 members, and the Congress was, of course, much smaller because we had fewer states. 75 members of Congress were members of this American Republican Party, which lying behind it was a secret society that was as rabidly anti-Roman Catholic as you could ever find. Now, Roman Catholicism also had some interesting responses. Roman Catholic revivalism, you might say. What do you mean, Roman Catholic revivalism? Yeah. There were Catholic priests who came to the United States, particularly Irish priests during this period, who took a look around and they saw how are the Protestants winning large numbers of their converts? Well, they hold mass revival meetings. More than one group can do this. So they started their own Catholic version of revivalism, where they had mass meetings. They would go around and find out, let's say, who all the Irish Catholics were in some locale. They would invite them to this meeting, and a priest who was a fiery preacher would sometimes be brought in, just like a revival preacher, and would preach really emotion-charged sermons. The difference would be, whereas Finney called you up to the anxious bench, the fiery Roman Catholic priest said, go to confession next Saturday. Get back in your parish and go to confession. So what you did with it was different, but the style was incredibly similar to revival meetings. And people have said this recouped a tremendous number of really lapsed nominal Catholics, especially among the Irish. Now, the Germans, not so much, because they would have to get German-speaking priests, and they did some of that. But it was especially profitable among the Irish Catholics. They had these kind of Catholic revival meetings. There were also a large number, moderately number of converts to Roman Catholicism during this period. Interestingly enough, among some American intellectuals, there were women who became influential, like Elizabeth Seton, who converted from Episcopalianism, she was the first American saint, I believe. She opened a famous school in Baltimore, and established the Sisters of Charity, which was a order of Catholic women, of nuns, that started caring for orphans. It's true, in 1975, she was made the first native-born American to be sainted. Near my home area, South Suburban Chicago, there was an Elizabeth Seton Catholic Girls High School. She was a kind of a patron saint for Roman Catholics. There were 51 different religious orders founded before the Civil War, and another 49 would be added before the 20th century. Now, this meant that Roman Catholicism would begin to become a serious force. Now, some places it would be incredibly thin. The South, with the exception of Louisiana, in spite of what Gone with the Wind shows you, where the family was Irish Catholics, the number of Irish Catholics who had plantations like Tara and Gone with the Wind was tiny. But Louisiana, all the French Cajuns. But where the Irish settled were in the bigger cities, sometimes smaller cities too, but Irish tended to settle New York, Boston, gradually bigger cities as it moved west. The Germans would settle in cities too, but the Germans would oftentimes be more rural. We have the 1840s is when Iowa was settled. You don't have to go very far south from here. down by Riverside to find German Catholics. I think those were mostly from Alsatia, Alsace-Lorraine. They would have called themselves Alsatians, but there's a whole bunch of people down, family names, old German names, Strabelis and Schnabelins, and just a bunch of other names down there of German Catholics. And St. Mary's Church down in Riverside was founded right during this period when Iowa was a frontier state. So they came in more rural communities. Now, there would be gradually be some others who would come, small pockets of Dutch and Belgium. There was a small minority in the Netherlands and the southern Netherlands that were Dutch Catholics. They came. Belgians would start to come. Luxembourgers. There were French Canadians who began to infiltrate down from French Canada into northern New England, especially in the mill towns, where they came to work in the what eventually would become the wood and paper mills of northern New England, would become heavily French Catholic. But we would start to see a sizable presence of the Roman Catholic Church. Now, this doesn't mean everything was always, as I said, smooth sailing between the various groups. But we still have a manageable number of groups. But the style would be different. The Irish are beginning to move into the leadership. The French priests are kind of passing away. Irish are moving into the leadership. We have a lot of German parishes as well. But you begin to notice the differences. German parishes, for an interesting reason, always built far more ornate churches. In Iowa City, we have a good example of the fact of what would be called the ethnic parish. When you go to Iowa City, most of those churches start in this period, and then later we have St. Mary, which was a German parish. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure what St. Patrick's parish was, or St. Wenceslaus was the Czech parish. And it also meant that Iowa City had a very different model than most Catholic cities. Because rather than Iowa City first being under one parish, you had three separate parishes. When those churches began to Anglicize, those members of the congregation started to spread, so you didn't have to go to the local parish. Because traditional Roman Catholicism said, if you lived in this block, you go to that parish. You could go visit all kinds of other parishes if you didn't like the priest, and as long as you were in Mass on Sunday, but technically you were a member and supposed to be in that parish. Iowa City didn't work that way. These numbers of ethnic parishes would mushroom in the era after the Civil War, when you started adding Italians and Czechs and Slovaks and Poles and Hungarians and all sorts of. Chicago, I grew up just south of Chicago. Chicago was loaded post-Civil War to World War I, when the great immigration came, with ethnic parishes. Every eight blocks, there would be a different neighborhood, and they'd have a different church dedicated to a different patron saint. The one Dutch Catholic parish was St. Willibrord's in South Chicago, and that's because Willibrord was the patron saint. He was a Dutch Catholic, and so they named it St. Willibrord's Catholic Church. Well, there were St. Patrick's churches all over the place, in every town, because we're Irish settled. St. Mary seems to be a favorite of German Catholics. And St. Wenceslaus and St. Ludmilla was a favorite of Czech Catholics. So the Catholics are making their presence here. Their numbers were probably far fewer in reality of devout Catholics than Beecher and all the frightened-to-death Protestants thought. But it stimulated Protestants to try to do home missions. There were converts to evangelical Protestantism. But we will discover later that some ethnic groups were far more prone. Strangely enough, Italians were far more likely to become evangelical Protestants. Poles, every mission to a Polish community from a Protestant group was almost a total fizzle. Yeah, and there were a number of very successful Italian Baptist and Presbyterian and Pentecostal things, because probably because most of the Italian men didn't go to church anyway. That was something the women did. The men ran them off, the men didn't go to church. That was something Italian women did. And when they really got converted, many of them would go to Protestant churches. So it's a very interesting history on this. So this is our story of the Roman Catholic Church. But we also have immigrant Protestants coming in. These are non-English speaking Protestants in large numbers during this period. I call these people insider outsiders. This starts to come home for me, because this touches my family. Two of my great-grandparents emigrated in the 1850s to Northwest Indiana. Matter of fact, my great-grandfather was My great-great-grandmother married the man. She was widowed when she came over, that they named the town of Munster, Indiana, after. And the original Dutch spelling looked like monster, but nobody wanted to be called Mr. Monster, so they changed it to Munster with a U. The Dutch, when you spell Munster, pronounce Munster in Dutch with an O, it gets a U sound. But anyway, that's when part of my family immigrated. They were devout Dutch Calvinists who immigrated from the Netherlands during this time. Their creed would be virtually identical to that of the mainstream, but they spoke different languages. The biggest percentage of them, the Dutch were a relatively small minority because it's a little tiny country, but the Germans were the largest numbers of them. But there were Swedes, Norwegians, Danes who start coming during this period. Between 1800 and 120 years later, in 1920, 40 million immigrants came. Think of that. 40 million immigrants came from Europe. A large number of them Protestant. Now, when they came over, though, they would have an interesting response to American evangelical Protestantism. It depended sometimes on what influences they had back in the old country. I might mention that some were affected by pietistic traditions. Remember, pietism is the heartfelt religion. That would be very similar to some of the themes of American revivalism. Well, some of my ancestors from the Netherlands had been very much affected by a pietistic revival in the Netherlands. And they would be looking for this heart-warm religion, but it took its own, oftentimes, distinct European form. Because the Dutch pietists that my ancestors, when they came over, would have been influenced by not only the emphasis on heart religion, but heart religion as expressed through the Dutch would say it, the oude schrijvers, which means the old writers. Because there were these 17th century Dutch pietist writers who had a version of Reformed theology that was very pious, very heart, but expressed in traditional Reformed terms. And they got here to the United States, and as my grandmother would sometimes say about some of their so-called, quote, American neighbors, ah, they do things so crazy, you know, and that's the way they looked at them. You know, what are these Americans? They do things so crazy compared to what we're used to. And they didn't fit in. Pietists sometimes would assimilate more easily. Sometimes they would convert to Baptist or Methodist. There was always a little stream of Germans who converted to Methodism. There were the Evangelical Association and the United Brethren, and there were other German Methodist sort of groups that had a very pietistic kind of low church Lutheranism that they became Methodists. But most of the groups kept some sort of nominal connection with their original confessional tradition. And let's talk then, well, let's go back here, and I'll fill in a few of the details before we go to the next group. The Lutherans. Colonial Lutherans had been organized and had a movement that was organized and was seeking to minister to mostly German immigrants. There were a few non-German. There were a couple of Dutch Lutheran churches, stray Dutch Lutheran churches, and a few others. But mostly they were Germans. But what had happened in the period in the 1820s, as revivalism had kicked up in the United States, there was a movement among some of the Lutherans to adapt Lutheranism to the American environment. There was a man named Samuel Schmucker. Not quite the same as Schmucker, the jelly people, but very similar, pronounced the same. Samuel Schmucker, who had studied at Princeton Seminary. And he was very impressed with the American Reformed mainstream. And he advocated what he called an American Lutheranism, which, as far as I can discern what it had watered down the distinctive Lutheranism that it looked really more like a very watered down Reformed theology than real Lutheranism. Because he watered down the distinctively Lutheran doctrine of the Lord's Supper with the real physical presence of Christ in the Supper. Well, we don't really need that. As long as we can talk about Jesus is there when you take communion, that's all that matters. And he was very much in favor of revivalism and other things. And for a while, it looked like this was going to totally sweep Lutherans in America. until two things. A man named Krauth, who wrote a book called The Conservative Reformation. And he argued Lutheranism was a more conservative branch of the Reformation and was a legitimate branch of the Reformation. And he began to influence people, Lutherans in America, away from this American Lutheran strand toward a more traditional Lutheranism. And we have the influx, the huge influx of all of these German, Norwegian, Danish, and Swedish immigrants, the majority of whom are at least nominally Lutheran in some way. You had groups like the Missouri Synod, famous Missouri Synod, which is a still large Lutheran, it's the largest Lutheran, Orthodox Lutheran denomination in the United States. Under Walter, they left in the 1840s from Germany precisely because the Prussian government was going to make them unite with the other Protestants into a union denomination that was just going to be called the Evangelical Church of Prussia. They were going to take the Reformed, the Lutherans, and everybody else who was nominally Protestant, and make it was nice and convenient for your government bureau, where the Prussians were organized in their government, and they put them all in one church. Well, the hardcore Orthodox Lutherans under Walter, and good stubborn Germans that they were, said, no way. What do? We come by the boatload to the Midwest. And they did. They're all over the Midwest. Missouri Synod Lutheran churches still practicing a very traditional Orthodox Lutheranism. There were other Lutheran synods too, and they had their internal squabbles. There was the Iowa Synod, the Buffalo Synod, the Wisconsin Synod, the Ohio Synod, and sometimes they debated among each other. There was a big debate over predestination. And I remember reading, I did a paper about this when I was in seminary because I was interested to see what happened during this period. And it's very interesting. Lutheranism is always a little hard to nail down what they really believe about predestination, because sometimes they sound like Calvinists and sometimes they sound like Arminians. And the whole debate was between the those who lean toward the Calvinist side calling the other ones Arminians and those who lean toward the Arminian side calling the other ones crypto-Calvinists. And they never solved it because Lutheranism itself is kind of ambiguous on that point. And they had a big, huge debate about it. But tons of ink was spilled over this issue among German-speaking Lutherans. When you add in all the Scandinavians, it gets even more complicated. The Norwegians founded probably a dozen or more different synods because they had been influenced by a couple of different movements. One was a pietistic movement under a man named Hauge, and another one was by a neo-confessional movement under a man named Gisel Johnson. And when they got here, they brought all of their tendencies with them. And they argued, and they debate, and they split, and they merged, and split again, and merged again, and split again, some of the synods, because they had different emphases. In Norway, you could still be a part of the state church and have your own flavor, if you will. But there's no state church, no state Lutheran church here. So they started their own different synods and argued. The Danes tended to split over how serious was your Christian life. And they joked and called them the Holy Danes and the Happy Danes. Because the Happy Danes were the ones who, this is a Danish folk church. Everybody here in town is Danish and everybody here is Lutheran. We don't get too upset as long as you show up to church most of the time. The Holy Danes they took it seriously. They were strict pietists and they had strict lifestyles. And turns out that in Western Iowa, almost every Danish community has two churches. Now, they're all part of the same synod today, but at one time, one would be the Holy Dane, one would be the Happy Dane church, because they founded two different churches. Swedes did the same thing. Sometimes Swedes would form union churches with Norwegians until they got enough either Swedes or Norwegians, and then they kicked the other out. Now, this is a Norwegian church. You Swedes, or now this is a Swedish church. You Norwegians go someplace else. They could understand each other's language enough that if there weren't enough of either group, they'd start a union church until they got enough of the other group, and then we don't want you guys anymore. Because, and all kinds of interesting things going on. The bottom line is that Lutherans were multiplying. They fit the insider-outsider because they're Protestants, but they're liturgical, sacramental, and with the exception of Schmucker's American Lutheranism, not prone to revivalism. And so the Midwest is full of Lutherans. Some of these immigrants would eventually drift off. The Swedes found all sorts of who had been influenced by revival movements would be susceptible to Baptist movement. There was the whole Swedish Baptist movement. There were evangelical free movements among Danish, Norwegian, and Swedish pietists. That's a little later. That's post-Civil War, mostly. But there would be little splinter groups. Methodists made some inroads among them. But by and large, the majority of Scandinavians remained Lutherans. The German and Reformed came. As I said, my own background. Iowa, we had lots of Dutch Reform. Pella was founded in the 1840s. This goes back to a movement heavily in the Netherlands where some of my own ancestors were involved. Matter of fact, one of my great-great-grandmothers was a member of the very church where the famous Afscheiding in the Netherlands got started, a splinter movement that wanted to restore orthodoxy to the Dutch Reformed Church, and they got in trouble because they were seen as revolting. They revolted against several things. One of them was the singing of those horrible hymns. They wanted to go back to singing psalms only, and they did. They had these horrible unreformed hymns in their hymnal, and they weren't going to sing those. Good stubborn Dutchmen, we're not singing those, and we're going to listen only to the Oudeschrijvers, the old writers. And some of the ministers rediscovered the Oudeschrijvers and started preaching historic Orthodox Reformed doctrine, and they got in trouble. And the seceders, as they called themselves, were never the dominant group among Dutch immigrants, but they were the most influential as far as setting the tone of the communities, because the people. Even those who weren't seceders were sympathetic toward them. And it's an interesting fact that among Dutch Reformed immigrants, the Netherlands, Orthodox Calvinists in the Netherlands during this period probably never made up more than a quarter of the population, but they made up about like 60 to 70% of the Dutch immigrants. So the immigrants who came were way overrepresented in numbers. So that all kinds of Dutch immigrant communities took on a very strict, classic Reformed flavor, like Pella. Strong Sabbath views and other all the things connected with classic Reform. There were German Reformed communities as well. And we'll talk a little bit more about the interesting theology of the German Reformed communities a little bit next week when we talk about theology during this period a little more specifically. But we need to talk about a little bit more about the more radical outsiders as we finish up. We've got a couple minutes tonight. I'm going to give you two examples. The Millerites and the Mormons. You know, I could go and talk a long time. I actually have taught a class on the varieties of American religion. I did it at the university a couple of times. And that's the kind of class that if you're in a church, you'd call a cults class. But at the university, you had to call it varieties of American religion. And the Mormons were a big part of that. But let's talk about the Millerites. Because this is a fascinating story about a man named William Miller, a New Hampshire farmer. Lived between 1742 to 1849, a self-educated farmer who was converted in the middle of his life from a skeptical background. He didn't believe anything, but he was converted. He started out as a Baptist. But here's a good example of how you can start from the evangelical mainstream and follow a path that will lead you into a very interesting sectarian side, Eddie. Because Miller became fascinated with biblical prophecy. Many of us have run into people who the only thing they've ever want to talk about is, quote, prophecy. And they watch hundreds of prophecy teachers with big charts on the TV, and they've got books all about prophecy, and the only thing they want to talk to you about is, who do you think the mark of the beast is? Who's the Antichrist? When is Christ coming back? Well, William Miller was like that. However, his model for prophecy is one that very few people follow today. Although it was common during that period, only he took it much further. Now, it was called a historicist. In other words, his argument was that Daniel and the book of Revelation have been mostly fulfilled in history, and you can, if you know how to count the numbers and match the people and the events in the book of Revelation with history, and add the numbers up correctly, you can predict, not the exact day, but the year, and close to the day, when Christ is going to return. He came to the conclusion that the second advent would occur in 1843. And he was very convinced of this. Now, it turns out that there was a local newspaperman who thought, this makes great copy. Let me start printing about Mr. Miller. And this guy started printing about him, and although he owned several local newspapers, and pretty soon he was a local New England phenomenon. Everybody wanted to hear Pastor Miller preach on, quote, prophecy, and when the second coming is going to occur. And a movement, a juggernaut steamroller movement, a large one, was developing. The promoter was a man named Joseph Himes, by the way, H-I-M-E-S. And finally, Miller got so bold that he actually eventually gave an exact date. March 21st, 1843. Jesus was going to return. And his followers all got ready. Many of them sold all their belongings and got ready. And we know the rest of the story. Jesus did not return in March 21st, 1843. So Miller, you might say, Miller probably then, we suspect, would have gone back and said, bad move. No, he just said, I got the calculations wrong. And he went back and recalculated and set a second date of October 2nd, 1844. And that came and went. There was a lot of opposition from the established churches, as you can guess. But you might say, okay, that's the end of that story. Well, not so fast. Because one of his followers said, you know, that date was right, but he had the wrong idea. Really what happened is something happened in heaven at that day. And Jesus went into a heavenly temple and cleansed the heavenly temple on that day and started the investiture judgment. Well, if you know anything about the history of one particular religious movement known as the Seventh-day Adventist, that's exactly where the Seventh-day Adventists came from, because one of their key ideas was the heavenly investiture judgment happened that day, and now we're just waiting. They do take a historicist interpretation of the book of Revelation. There was a woman named Ellen G. White who was part of that movement, and she was became eventually seen as a prophet. They, by contact with some Seventh-day Baptists, they adopted Seventh-day worship, and they were often running with a relatively orthodox, I say relatively orthodox on most issues, but still unorthodox on a number of key things, group. All basing its fact that Miller came out of the evangelical mainstream and took that turn. It's a good lesson, by the way, I think, to all of the TV preachers with their prophecy charts and all the guys, Hal Lindsey's of this world, who wrote all those books that claimed Christ was going to return at a certain time, because every one of those guys has been proven to be wrong. Most of even the method that Miller used has been totally abandoned by 99% of interpreters of the scripture. But he was absolutely certain. His method and his dates were right. He was a typical populist, optimistic, and primitivist strand, because he was just returning back to the scriptures. Pure scripture, he said. See, I can show you. I got all my ideas just by adding up the numbers in the Bible. I came out with this. I don't need those fancy theologians to tell me about this. I can add up numbers better than anybody else. And he added up the numbers, and it's been estimated that somewhere between 30 to 100,000 followers took part in the Great Disappointment. Some of them who ended up being rather jaded by the whole thing, as you can imagine. If you've sold everything you owned, waited. Now, the apocryphal stories that they were on top of Mount Washington in white ascension robes, then that's been proven to not really be as accurate as some people have said. But clearly, they were disappointed. One last group we want to talk about, the Mormons. Talk about them just for a couple of minutes. I could talk for hours about the Mormons if we wanted to. In some ways, the most radical departure from traditional Christianity, and yet in some ways the most typically American of all these groups. The founder, Joseph Smith, came from a family that had it was an interesting blend of revivalistic Protestantism and weird occultic backgrounds. On one side of his mom's family, they had dabbled in the occult, magic potions, fortune-telling for generations. On his dad's side of the family, I believe it was, they had been involved in revivalistic Protestantism. He first shows up in history in a court case in which he was sued because he claimed he could find buried treasure by using a special rod that he had. And he didn't find the buried treasure. And the guy sued him for not finding the buried treasure. He claimed that he had a vision in 1820 in which he was told that all of the churches were wrong and he should start his own, and he would have visions throughout the rest of his life. Now here's where Joseph Smith, who claimed to have his golden plates and all of these other things, we forget, though, that he imbibed a lot of different things. Besides the magical cult tradition, he imbibed the revivalist tradition, the optimistic revivalist tradition. Mormonism denies original sin, has the highest view of the freedom of human, the free will. Why? Because he imbibed all of that. He was in the area where Finney was operating, who was telling everybody, you got, quote, free will. It's up to you. You're the one who turns the switch. You're the one. You know, we don't need any supernatural work from God. Humans have free agency to do all of this. Well, Smith took that, melded it with the occult tradition, and a lot of interesting ideas of his own. His view on baptism is certainly from the Campbellite tradition, because he added a key convert in Sidney Rigdon, who had been a Campbellite pastor, who had emphasized baptism was essential. By immersion was your essential conversion of in your life. All these things were brought together by Joseph Smith. Now, he obviously scandalized people when he eventually started having more visions and plural marriage and all of that, and there's a long history of Mormonism. I can talk more about that. But the important point to see is that Joseph Smith wasn't just a strange guy who came up with weird views. His weird views came in a context in which a lot of people were open to that sort of thing. And he emphasized optimistic Americanism. The kingdom of God would come where? To America. Actually, he says it's going to be in Independence, Missouri. The interesting thing about that is the place in Independence, Missouri, where it's supposed to be owned by the reorganized Mormons who don't get along with the Utah Mormons, and they won't sell the piece of property. And so there's this inner Mormon fight over who's got the right to the property where the actual temple, the final temple, is supposed to be built. All of these things get blended into Mormonism, and Smith, of course, kept having vision after vision, as he claimed the rest of his life, kept adding more and more strange beliefs. But many of these were popular simply because he imbibed the times. And people who had been ramped up for high-powered revivalism of an optimistic human nature approach didn't find it always difficult to transition into Mormonism. Mormonism is a strange combination of rationalism, everything is, quote, rational, with pure subjectivism. You know, the famous Mormon apologetic, how do I know it? I got a burning in my bosom that says it's true. But everything else is, quote, rational, but it's all based on the burning in the bosom. And Joseph Smith welded all of that together in his interesting religion. Well, we'll stop with this. We probably have time for just about 2 minutes worth of minutes for questions. If you have other questions on Mormonism, maybe I could pick up a few of them next week. But we hopefully covered the outsiders, and we're going to come back and talk more about theology and then switch into the Civil War next week. He clearly was out of that, only he was a Scot who went down there and learned and became a Dutch Reformed. The South African colony has a slightly different history. They weren't as impacted as much by the movements in the Netherlands, but somewhat.
Were they impacted by
the Pietism more? Yes, they were. Murray brought a form of Pietism to that that they followed. Yes, but in their own strange way. I don't know the tradition really well, but I know that